Florida's journalists fight back against the term fake news. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, we'll tell you why reporters in the Sunshine State are trademarking the term fake news. What do you think about that? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, spotlighting Dyslexia Awareness Month. Find out about this city's GRASP Academy and what they're doing to help kids with dyslexia. But first this morning, it is an innovative way to fight back against the war on our free press. Take a listen.
Here at the Society of Professional Journalists, we're deeply concerned about how a certain president of the United States is using the label fake news to discredit the free press. Real fake news isn't news at all. It's completely made up, ignoring the very fundamentals of journalism, like facts and sources. So how do you stop that guy in the Oval Office from confusing the American people with his incorrect use of the term fake news? You trademark it. And now, every time the White House head honcho uses the term incorrectly, we'll send him a cease and desist letter. But it's not just a certain head of state we're going after. From now on, any politician, celebrity, or outraged tweeter who uses the term to cast doubt on stories they disagree with, you'll be hearing from us. So America, let's join together to make sure that one misleading catchphrase doesn't shake our belief in the very symbol of our democracy, a free and independent press. See the work that journalists are doing to report the truth.
All right, so can trademarking the term fake news shore up credibility to an institution, the Fourth Estate, that has been battered by the use of this term? Right now, we're pleased to welcome Emily Block, president of the Society of Professional Journalists Florida chapter. She's also an education reporter with the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What do you think about the term fake news and the Society of Professional Journalists trademarking the term to fight back against the use of this term? People increasingly say something is fake news if it's a story they don't like, and they're unable to distinguish between factual information and propaganda sites that have proliferated on the web and on Facebook. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Okay. So how did the Society of Professional Journalists here in Florida come up with this idea?
Sure. So I'm a longtime member of the Society of Professional Journalists. I joined in college. And over the years, I've noticed that our mission, especially the Florida chapter, has started to change. I mean, it used to be a trade organization giving journalists tools that they needed to be better journalists. But over the years, we've started shifting our goals to also include the general public, non-journalists, and teaching them media literacy, teaching them about what journalists do.
Right. And so why did they come up with this idea?
So it kind of goes into that media literacy. So over the years, as President Trump's platform has grown larger and larger, and in his term as president, he has increasingly used the term fake news as a way to shrug off stories that he doesn't like, stories that he disagrees with or he doesn't think portray him well. He just calls fake news. And we're not okay with that.
So how did they come up with the idea of trademarking the term fake news, and what is that intended to do?
So we've worked with an ad agency out of Canada. They're called WAX, and every year they do one big project pro bono for a cause that they care about. So they decided they wanted to do something with freedom of press, and they reached out to us, and that's how the ball got rolling. So we decided, okay, well, what's the most outrageous thing we could do to get the president's attention? So we decided, okay, this is a businessman we're talking about. Let's go with a trademark. So we applied for a trademark for the term fake news and decided that every time that he uses it against the media, we're going to send a cease and desist. And I want to point out that obviously we don't think the trademark is actually going to get approved. It's pending right now, but it's a phrase that anyone can use. And Donald Trump didn't create it himself. It's been used years before he even became president or started popularizing it. So we don't intend for it. We don't expect it to get approved. But while it's pending, we're going to ride it out.
Okay. It's 549-2937 to join us. So it sounds like an attention getting idea and a way to push back against the attacks on the media's credibility.
Absolutely. So if you go to fakenewstm.com, which is where the video routes people to, or our social media as well, it actually is a media literacy campaign. And it tells readers, this is how you could check if a story is credible. This is what the Society of Professional Journalists do. Here's our ethics code. And it's not a whole website about trademarking. It's a website about media literacy and what we actually do.
And by the way, here is the code of ethics for the Society of Professional Journalists. Number one, seek the truth and report it. Number two, minimize harm, balance the public's need for information against potential harm or discomfort. It's not a license for arrogance or undue intrusiveness when you report information. Act independently, serve the public, avoid conflicts of interest, and be accountable and transparent. Ethical journalism means taking responsibility for your work and explaining your reporting decisions to the public.
Right.
So there's a code of ethics that professional journalists adhere to. And the thing that's so disturbing in recent times is what we've seen culturally, that people get their news from sources that fit their ideology. And there is no one neutral arbiter of what is the news. People are living increasingly in this country in parallel realities. There isn't a shared reality anymore, which is not good for our democracy.
No, not at all. We're supposed to be journalists. We're supposed to be the checks and balances. We're supposed to be the watchdogs. We seek truth and report it. We shine lights on news that isn't reported on, that things people want to know about and need to know about for their livelihood. And when you shrug it off and call it fake news, it's hurting the discourse.
Mm-hmm. And is this only Florida journalists that have hit upon this tactic, or is this a national effort?
So we've had backing from our region, Region 3, which includes Alabama, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands. National knows about it. They haven't signed on as of yet. We've opened the invitation for them to back it. I haven't heard back yet. But that's not new for us. SPJ Florida, we've historically taken stances on things that National has been a little more cautious in touching.
We're talking with reporter Emily Block of the Florida Times Union about Florida journalists trademarking the term fake news. They say they're tired of President Trump using the phrase as a way to undermine the work of journalism that's holding his administration accountable. They've applied for a trademark and will start sending cease and desist letters to anyone who uses the term. What do you think about that? It's 549-2937. Now, speaking of the news, you cover education for the Florida Times Union, and yesterday there was a hearing in court over a big local issue, the Duval County School Board's lawsuit against the city over the city's efforts to slow down efforts by the school board to levy a half-cent sales tax for school repair and construction. What happened in court?
Yes. So this was the first hearing, and this hearing was to address two motions. The first was to strike Duval Teachers United, which is the teachers union, from this from representation. And the second was to discredit the outside counsel, to disqualify the outside counsel that the school board and the teachers union have hired. So far, no conclusions have been met. The judge heard both sides. It was a 2-hour hearing, 1 hour for each side. And there was a lot of roundabout conversation, but there's no conclusions yet.
No conclusions yet, but there were some interesting exchanges that you reported on in court.
Yes, absolutely. So one thing that stood out to me is that the whole 2 hours really revolved around one underlying question, and it is, where does the school board fall under the consolidation charter? So everything goes back to the charter. that was written 50 something years ago, which is crazy to think about now and how much impact it's had on the city, on the school board, on a referendum. But it really revolves around where do they fall under that?
So the city is arguing that the school board, being part of the city county government, can't even hire its own lawyer. The school board is arguing, yes, we can, and we are an independent authority.
Correct. And that's where the judge is trying to clarify, well, what does an independent authority mean? So the Judge Wilkinson's take was, well, an independent authority doesn't necessarily mean they can't hire outside counsel, right? But again, there's no real solid conclusions yet. He was kind of just hearing both sides.
And to be clear, this is part of the school board's effort to put a referendum before the voters to vote up or down a proposed half-cent sales tax increase that would go towards shoring up school buildings around the county, which are many of them in a state of disrepair.
Yes, the funding is meant to go toward a $1.9 billion master plan for facility repairs and safety and security across schools.
And let's explain for those who haven't followed it closely why the city is fighting this effort.
So the city is saying that they needed, well, they've asked a lot of questions of the school board, and it's been a months-long effort that we've detailed in our reporting. But it really comes down to the city wanting more in the back end. They wanted more planning. They wanted to know more about the timeline. They wanted to know more about which schools are getting it prioritized. And they've also asked about more charter school funding. They've asked about the model that Duval Schools is using, where right now they're using per square footage, but the city council, many members of city council, have recommended per pupil funding.
Okay, and as we talk about all of this and the move by SPJ, Society of Professional Journalists, to trademark the term fake news, this takes us back to another headline that's breaking this morning. Speaking of news, the Public Opinion Research Lab at UNF has a new poll out here in Florida that shows where the state's residents stand regarding the formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump. 48% of registered voters in Florida approve of the House of Representatives beginning an impeachment inquiry. 47% disapprove. So no surprise, Florida is just about evenly split on this impeachment question. Younger voters are far more likely to favor impeachment than older voters in the state. Democrats, no surprise, far more likely to support it than Republicans. Independents are split. The survey also shows a majority of Floridians disapprove of Donald Trump's performance as president. What that means for him in 2020, what remains to be seen, of course. A lot can happen between now and next November. But as we talk with the TU's Emily Block about lots of news, we want your calls. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Jeff is on the South Side. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Wanted to bring up one point that gets completely overlooked. On the 7th of August of 2016, a guy named Rutenberg had on the front page of the New York Times, above the fold on the left side, the primary position, a statement, an article that said that because he did not agree that Mr. Trump should be nominated for the president, for the presidential election, that he would not be bound by the ethics rules that he had learned in journal school. Until that particular statement is spoken out against by the media people, they're going to be suspect.
Was that an editorial or a news article, Jeff?
No, it was a news article on the front page, and it Rutenberg's byline was media editor in one word, which I haven't been able to track back any particular position. But it was a news article on the front page of the New York Times.
Okay,
7th of August.
Thanks for that, Jeff. I haven't read that article, so I will look it up.
I do know that Rutenberg is a media columnist. I haven't read that particular article.
So it was an opinion piece.
I don't remember the particular article he's referring to, but I do know that Rutenberg is a media columnist.
Okay. So, and we no longer have Jeff on the line, but to be clear, there is always supposed to be a very clear delineation at all media organizations between what reporters do and what opinion columnists write. And so that columnist wrote a piece that Jeff took exception to. Mm-hmm. I'll have to go back and look at it. I'm not familiar with what he said. If he did say that he would no longer be bound by the rules of ethics in journalism, certainly that damages the credibility of the New York Times in the eyes of a lot of readers. I would agree with the caller on that. That said, you know, the majority of the mainstream media outlets covering this administration and local outlets like the Times Union covering their communities, by and large, adhere to a code of ethics. You have to, or you have no credibility. Nobody's going to believe what's in your paper or on your airwaves. You have to make every attempt to get the best available information. You seek more than one source for any story, especially a controversial story. You're transparent. You report without fear or favor. You try not to favor one group over another. These are basic building blocks of good reporting.
101. If we didn't do it, we wouldn't have jobs.
Okay, let's go to Jody in the Intercoastal West area. Go ahead, Jody.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I heard yesterday that the president called the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution phony. And my question really is to the patriots in our community and in our entire country, why in the world is his essentially thumbing his nose at the Constitution not profoundly offensive to Americans everywhere?
Thanks for that, Jody. And he did refer to the Emoluments Clause as phony. It is not phony, to be clear. It is in the Constitution. Sitting presidents are barred from profiting from their connections and blandishments from foreign governments while they hold office, because the idea being that a foreign government could exert improper influence on presidential decision making. And this gets back to the decision by the president, the initial decision to hold the next G7 summit at his Doral resort in South Florida. He later scrapped that plan because he took a lot of criticism, particularly from Republicans in the House of Representatives, who said they just couldn't defend that because it was such a blatant violation of the Emoluments Clause. And so, but to the deeper issue, half of America is outraged by things like this, Emily. The other half is fine with it. And that shows you where the division is. If you are getting your news from the Washington Post, the New York Times, NPR, these are all outlets that are working hard to report fairly on what has been, and this is simply stating the facts, a string of controversies that have engulfed this administration. If you get your news from other outlets, and particularly from Facebook, which has been criticized for freely platforming websites that aren't journalistic websites, that are misleading propaganda sites, if you get your news from that source, you really are not getting factual information about these issues.
Exactly. And this goes back to the rhetoric that we're fighting against with this trademark pending. It really goes into just how often Trump uses the term fake to brush off things that he doesn't like. And I have a story that came out in a column that came out in Teen Vogue this morning about why we have applied for a trademark. And it goes into just how often Trump uses fake as an excuse, not just the fake media, which he did even when backing out of the G7 summit. He used fake news as a reason why, but fake everything, fake Constitution, fake amendments, fake news, et cetera, et cetera. And we've noticed and actually reported that he uses it almost daily at this point.
And we have been sent the link to the column by Jim Rutenberg, August 7th, 2016 in the New York Times. The headline reads, "Trump is testing the norms of objectivity in journalism." This is a column, not a news article. It's an opinion piece.
Which brings us back to the reason why we've published fake news TM.com and why we have focused so much on media literacy. It's about teaching the public how to determine what articles are credible and how to tell if an article is straight facts or if it is a column.
But this brings up, I think, an uncomfortable question. When someone at a respected outlet says, this president is testing longstanding rules of ethics in journalism, that does give an opening for people who might otherwise read the New York Times and take it seriously to say, well, I can't take this seriously anymore if you have a prominent member of your staff saying, I'm no longer going to try to cover this administration objectively.
Right. Well, I think it shows just how unprecedented this entire presidency has been. We're in untreaded water where at rallies, he's pointing at the press club and saying, those are the bad guys. And you have rally attenders attacking journalists. And we have people walking on airplanes wearing rope journalist, no assembly required t-shirts and things like that. And I mean, I'm a young reporter, but I don't remember a situation where it's been this grave of a division.
Jennifer emails the show, this is an information literacy issue. With the proliferation of information on the internet, schools need to do a better job of teaching students how to evaluate the information they find and selecting the most reputable sources. That is so important because I remember a recent study showed a lot of students can't determine any difference between a website that is adhering to these codes of journalism and a propaganda site, which looks like a newspaper, but isn't.
It's not just students. It's everyone. The Society of Professional Journalists Florida Pro Chapter, we have a program called the Fake News Game Show. And it's a media literacy lesson where we hold on a slideshow an actual article versus a fake article, a satirical article, a made up article, something that was on the internet on someone's Facebook page. And we have people determine which one is real. And a lot of times, even journalists are stumped when they see them stripped and side by side like that. And we offer that lesson to classrooms and to students.
Lots of tweets. Here's one from a listener. Society is not blameless. Most people have no ability to discern what is real and what is patently fake, false, counterfeit. The majority of society is incapable of research and fact-checking on their own. Wikipedia is not fact-checking. Another tweet. Why are local news outlets less likely to fact-check politicians, especially in real time? It seems they always try to find a balance, even when the story is blatantly false.
Okay. Well, I we work really hard to tell both sides of the story, and we do fact-check. And maybe we don't always have the means of a ProPublica or a Politico and are able to do a live fact-check on the spot. But of course, any journalist who cares about journalism is fact-checking and is going and making sure that everything they're publishing is credible.
Here's another tweet. I am a subscriber to the New York Times, but they pushed the fake Hillary email story ad nauseum. Okay, the New York Times did take a ton of criticism from progressives for really, and so did a lot of other media outlets, to be fair, for really playing up Hillary Clinton's improper use of a private email server. And so both progressives and conservatives can find fault with major media outlets.
Of course.
So let's be clear on that. 549-2937, lots of calls. Ofe is on the South Side. Ofe, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? Go ahead.
Okay. My question was, I'm concerned about the impact of the presidential behavior on local and state government. People are convicted and put on trial for their behavior of misleading the public and misusing public funds. This behavior, to me, gives them some precedent to use in the future.
I think that's a really good point. It kind of goes back to our campaign on fake news, where we mentioned that it's not just the president who's doing this, that the president's behavior has trickled down to local government, that other politicians are using the term fake news to brush off stories they like, that even local government, hyper local government in Jacksonville, I can tell you multiple times, have brushed off Times Union stories by calling them fake when they're obviously not fake.
Who's done that?
I mean, I have back and forth tweets with our mayor that have called my reporting sloppy and lazy. And I don't think just because you disagree with a story, there's reason to do that.
And, you know, it's nothing new for politicians to criticize the way they're covered.
Not at all.
That's been the case forever.
Tale as old as time.
What's new now is that there's an attempt to discredit all of media altogether, to make people feel as though they can't believe anything that they read or hear. And that's troubling, given that a free press, accountability of our political leadership, that is the purpose of a free press, to inform the public about what's going on with their local and federal government and to hold accountable wrongdoing. That's why journalists do what they do.
Of course. We seek truth and report. That's our role.
Chuck is at the beaches. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, guys. I don't have a problem with our press. I think our press is great. And I think that I got the biggest library on the planet right here in my hand. I can look up anything on this phone. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to remind your guests there that the Rolling Stone magazine was sued by a university CEO who was a woman, and Rolling Stone magazine lost a bunch of money because they printed a false sexual assault listing against her. And I think if you go back and look, you'll see that Dan Rather lost mm-hmm. his job because of some things that he did. And if you go back and you look at, I read a book by Doris Kearns Goodwin twice, it's 700 pages long, and half the book is about newspapers in the South, in Virginia, during the Civil War. What do you think they said about Abraham Lincoln? And Lincoln said that about newspapers. He said, they lie and then they re-lie. This is nothing new. It's always been that way. And because I've got this biggest library in my hand, which is my phone, we're not stupid out here. We know how to read and we know how to find the information. And so it's nothing new. And there are things like the Rolling Stone magazine that got sued and Dan Rather that lost his job.
But in both of those cases, there was accountability, Chuck. If reporting was
right,
misleading or false, those folks were held accountable.
And completely denounced in the journalism community.
Yeah. I would just add that to your point is all I'm saying.
Right. But I think on a basis, and I listen to you every day.
Well, thanks.
And you're great. So I like to get both sides of the story, but we're not stupid out here. We can see when people are, and Trump, he goes to the extreme, and I understand that. But so does Pelosi, and so does Adam Schiff. Thank you very much.
Okay, Chuck, thanks for that. Here's an email from Ryan. There is only one perspective presented. The media is biased, and there is evidence from CNN and the New York Times that this is so. It doesn't exonerate Trump for his bad behaviors. But it seems the media is unwilling to look itself in the mirror and see its own bias in both directions. Emily.
I mean, I personally would disagree. I think that's why things such as the code of ethics exist. It's to keep journalists in check and remind them why they do what they do every day. But I think it's important to realize that we don't get anything out of lying. Like there would be no benefit. A reporter that violates the code of ethics, that does something unethical, that reports on something biased, is going to get called out by their readers, obviously, as they should, and it'll trickle down and up. They won't have a job.
Here is a tweet from Teresa. My issue with the New York Times is that they pushed that email issue on their front page for months, and now that the Department of Justice has found that the email stuff wasn't an issue, the New York Times had it on page 13, one small paragraph. Why aren't all news organizations publishing this on the front page? Another reference to Hillary Clinton's email story. People have long memories about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of other stories, people of different political persuasions. And so I think the big takeaway from all of this is that what Emily, you're trying to say is, the vast majority of journalists are doing the best they can, by the way, in a difficult climate where layoffs and budget cuts are rampant, trying to adhere to a code of ethics, trying to maintain credibility. And if you have issues with this or that media outlet, that's fine. But I'm going to editorialize a little bit now and say, it is so important that we preserve a free press. It is the absolute hallmark of our free and open society. We have to fight for it every way we can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, a lot of the comments that we've heard about this campaign are, oh, well, readers know what to if a story is real or fake. But it turns out that studies are saying otherwise. Studies are showing that readers are being confused by fake news rhetoric. Studies are also showing that, I have the stat on me, 40% of Republicans say accurate news stories that cast a politician or a political group in a negative light should be considered fake news. And we just don't find that to be okay. If you're calling something fake news to discredit it, that's not cool.
Right. So the research, do your own research, as one caller said. Seek out multiple sources of information and check out this new website. It's fakenewstm.com. Where do you take this from here?
We're going to send cease and desist letters as long as the trademark is pending. And we're going to hope that people reach out to us, that they want to hear more about media literacy, that they go to this website and learn how to fact check a story for themselves. But if they want to learn more, they can reach out to us. All our contact information is down there at the bottom. And like I said, we do a fake news game show. We do hands-on programs, and we've brought it to public libraries. We've brought it to breweries. We've brought it to coffee shops, and we've brought it to classrooms, middle, high school, and college. So we want to help, and we want to teach the public what we do and why it matters.
Emily Block with the Society of Professional Journalists and the Florida Times Union. Again, that website, fakenewstm for trademark.com. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
And up next, help for Duval County students with dyslexia at Jacksonville's GRASP Academy. That's after this.
$9.90 get you access to the very best in science, nature, and history docs. Introducing WJCT's newest member benefit, PBS Passport Plus Curiosity Stream. Now for the first time, you can get access to all of the great documentaries on PBS's Passport, and also get access to the incredible collection of Curiosity Stream, the new documentary service created by the founder of the Discovery Channel. A $9.90 monthly contribution gets you ongoing access to both Curiosity Stream and PBS's Passport service. It's a member benefit unlike any we've ever created and available only from WJZT. Sign up today to get all the documentaries you love anytime, anywhere, on any device. Passport plus Curiosity Stream together for $9.90 per month.
Welcome back. Well, it's one of the most common language-based learning disabilities. Between 5 to 10% of the population is estimated to have dyslexia. And dyslexia can manifest itself really early on in kids. They have difficulties in spoken language, also reading, writing, and spelling. Teachers can now identify kids at risk for dyslexia as early as preschool. Now, this month, October, is National Dyslexia Awareness Month. Communities nationwide are working to raise awareness about the needs of kids and adults with dyslexia. That includes here in Jacksonville. Anessa Powell is the principal at Jacksonville's GRASP Academy, which works with kids dealing with dyslexia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. All right, so tell us more about GRASP Academy. It started several years ago, and it's grown rapidly, hasn't it?
It has. We are in our fourth year at our current location. We have approximately around 300 students. We would love to see around 350, 400 students would be our goal. And it's a unique learning environment for students with learning differences, including dyslexia, dysgraphia, and dyscalculia. We are the only school in, the only public school in Northeast Florida. I believe in the state of Florida, there are a couple of charter schools in other states, but I don't know of any public schools. And so Duval County, through GRASP Academy, offers students some unique learning opportunities, just focusing on how our students with dyslexia learn best.
And you mentioned not only dyslexia, but dyscalculia and dysgraphia. Let's explain what those are.
So dyscalculia is a difficulty in math.
That's my kids.
Yes.
Although I don't, I tried to get the test done for them. It was $1,500. So I don't know whether they have dyscalculia or not. I think they just don't like math. But
and that's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because GRASP Academy in Duval County does not require a formal diagnosis to come to our school. And just like you mentioned, that can be very, very expensive.
Yeah, I didn't want to spend the money to find out if they had dyscalculia. So this is one example of what parents deal with if their child is having trouble, trying to figure out if they need a diagnosis and what to do about it, right?
Absolutely. So financially, it's okay. It's also genetic. So you may have had, it's okay that you struggle with reading because my aunt struggled with reading, your uncle struggles with reading, and those type of things. But there are things and symptoms and opportunities that Duval County offers that can help some students.
Okay, so for parents listening and they think their child might have dyslexia and might benefit from GRASP Academy, what are some signs and symptoms of dyslexia? When would you be figuring out, okay, my child might be dealing with this?
So we start in first grade. And we accept applicants from first through eighth grade. And the reason is, I would say that you should always give your homeschool an opportunity. You know, so go ahead, let your student go to kindergarten, see what strategies that those teachers have and that are offered through some different programs that Duval County offers. And then if they still struggle with that decoding piece and you start hearing things like they're not living up to their potential, or, they're doing okay, but they struggle, or you start to have conversations about retention, then I would say give us a shot. Go on our website, apply, find out a little bit about us. It's more than just the reading piece. It's hard for people to understand. It's delayed shoe tying. It's executive functioning issues, confidence. All of those things play a part in dyslexia.
Interesting. Delayed shoe tying. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There may be a genetic component to dyslexia. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And so often you don't really think about dyslexia because in your family, people have struggled to read, or in your family, everybody has ADHD and struggles in the classroom, but dyslexia has a genetic component in it.
One example of a dyslexic kid is transposing letters, right? B and D, for example, not being able to always distinguish between them. That's I'm just trying to paint a picture for people listening to how it manifests.
So it's transposing letters. It's anytime some of the characteristics that we look for, having difficulties with letter sounds. The teachers will call it phonemic awareness. So even though you say a sound, you're not able, or you have difficulty identifying the sound with the symbol. So like a long A with an A, those types of things, with reversals and directional terms. And so when we say direction, sometimes we think of left to right, but a directional term is also the front of the classroom, the back of the classroom. And so those kinds of activities. Yeah, ADHD and dyslexia often go hand in hand.
Often go together.
They do. It's a comorbidity.
Now, Principal Powell, you are on the dyslexic spectrum, which gives you extraordinary sensitivity to these kids and how they can best be educated, I'm told.
You would be correct. And so I'm a struggling learner, and I have struggled with it my whole life. But I am older, and so we did not call it dyslexia. We called it struggling learner. And I remember struggling with it. I was one of those kids that had to go to summer school every year. And I, had failing grades and I was always in the lowest reading group. But I had a couple of teachers that really did some out of the box thinking for me. I had a fifth grade mm-hmm. teacher who let me stand up and didn't make me go to the third grade Bluebirds reading class. And I appreciate that. And I had a sixth grade teacher that read to us. And it was the first time I ever remember reading a book. It's Where the Red Fern Grows. Uh-huh. Even though I didn't physically read it, she read it to me. And that really helps me connect and it makes me passionate about the work.
Let's go to Gary in Jacksonville. He's got a question about dyslexia and Grasp Academy. Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm listening to your show. It's very interesting. But there's one thing that my son was diagnosed, and I call it audio dyslexia, meaning he didn't hear the same word in both ears.
Hmm. So you're wondering if how that can be addressed? How that can be...
Well, when they speak dyslexia, they always speak of visual. But... is it possible that it could be an audio dyslexia problem versus a visual?
Okay, thanks for that question. Anessa, Principal Powell.
So dyslexia, and I'm glad you brought that up, is dyslexia is actually language-based disorder. We think of visual because a lot of people talk about reversals and handwriting and spelling, but really it's how you're processing the language. And so some of our students do struggle with language processing as far as it takes a little bit longer to process information than there's one thing that we do a lot is that rapid recall. We ask kids to just recall as fast as you can. And that's difficult for my students because it's that language processing.
But he should get in touch with you at Grasp
Absolutely.
Academy. And here's how you can do it. Go to DuvalSchools.org/GRASP, G-R-A-S-P. And they will screen your child, Gary. Now, this is interesting, too, and it's so important for parents. If your child is accepted to attend Grasp Academy, which is a public school, they get free transportation to the school, and they'll also get the benefit of the Orton-Gillingham methodology. This is a phonics-based multisensory approach that involves three pathways of learning, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, helping kids learn in a different way, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And we're not like a magnet school. You know, magnet schools, you have to take, they go to hubs. You know, Duval County is dedicated to this work and offers transportation from all over the region. We also have parents that come from Nassau or from Yulee. We have parents that come from St. John's County, from Clay County. We don't provide transportation there, but... Mm-hmm.
But anywhere in Duval.
Anywhere in Duval County.
If you have a student with dyslexia or dyscalculia, or dysgraphia, even if they don't have a diagnosis and you think Grasp Academy would work, definitely go to the website DuvalSchools.org/GRASP. It's National Dyslexia Awareness Month. So thank you so much, Anessa Powell. She's principal at Grasp Academy, a public school in Jacksonville. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A quick break, and up next, Claws for a Cause. What's that? We'll explain next.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2 possesses an overwhelming depth of melody. You'll hear it performed by the symphony and piano virtuoso Natasha Peremski, whom the London Classical Source calls fiery and widely dynamic. Piano virtuoso Natasha Peremski joins the symphony for Brahms' wonderfully melodic Piano Concerto No. 2, October 25th and 26th.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about the U.S. troops' pullout from the part of Syria that had been controlled by the Kurds with the Washington Post's Beirut bureau chief Liz Sly. She's been covering the Syrian civil war since it started in 2011. She's in the U.S. to receive an award for courage in journalism from the International Women's Media Foundation. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Lots of companies are criticized for not being diverse enough and have spent a ton of money trying and failing to fix the problem.
If it's not rooted in the main of the corporate structure, the chances are it's not going to work.
I'm Kai Rizdal, trying and failing to get diversity right, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Texas is a key place to run for president, especially for a native son. Beto O'Rourke represented El Paso in the House. Now he's battling to stay in the Democratic primary race. His progressive agenda is finding an audience and getting strong pushback from some conservatives. Our series Foresight 2020 continues with your questions for Beto O'Rourke next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, Cool Moose Coffee Company is beloved for its popular brunch and all its other goodies at the corner of Park and King in Avondale. This weekend, though, they are serving up some delicious claws for a cause. Lobster claws, that is. Owner Lori Jarvis is here with more. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, I don't always think of Cool Moose as a place to go for lobster, but this weekend it is, it sounds like.
Yes. You know, we are so thankful for our community. We do Claws for a Cause twice a year, and we partner with a non-for-profit organization that we're passionate about because our community has supported us for so long. So we want to give back in that way.
You're partnering with City Rescue Mission for this whole bash. They, of course, work with the homeless and the needy in downtown Jacksonville. So when people come out and eat some lobster, they're helping fund City Rescue Mission.
Exactly. My passion for City Rescue Mission comes from my mom actually going through the program. She went to the residential recovery program. People think City Rescue Mission is just a place where, you know, like you said, they feed the homeless and the needy, but they actually have a life builder program there. And my mom, she was a beautiful, wonderful woman who was a business owner. And she just had, you know, mental illness, physical illness, and then also some trauma in her life that created a situation where she had to use the Life Builder program at City Rescue Mission.
That's an example of how easy it is for someone to fall into a negative spiral.
Yeah.
And, it's you know, people need to understand that. Okay. So tell me about the Big Bash. What is going to happen at Claws for a Cause?
Oh, gosh. It's so exciting. So we have right now 15 tickets left. And Curtis DeVork is going to MC the night.
Mr. Former Jackson DeVille himself.
Yes.
Curtis Dvorak.
Dvorak, excuse me.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, it starts at 6:15 and we're going to have a VIP reception. And then at 7 o'clock, we're going to start the night. And it's going to be a four-course meal. But the beautiful thing is we're going to hear from people that have graduated from the City Rescue Mission program. And we're also going to partner with them in trying to raise funds for things that they are in need of at this point.
And yeah, and what are they most in need of? Do you know?
Yes. So the three things that we're partnering them with is the Red Barn renovation. It's a 3,000 square foot building that they need renovated. And that is currently at $3,500 that they need. We also are going to do new flooring for a medical clinic, and that's $3,800. And then the last thing is women's emergency service shower room for $7,500.
Okay. To do all this, you're going to be serving up a lot of lobster. Maine lobster, baby.
Yes, we are.
Tell me what's on the menu.
So we are going to fly in fresh Maine lobster Friday night. And we also have clam chowder, New England steamed mussels. And we also have a house-made dessert. And if you do not like lobster, we have steak tips and eggplant parmesan for vegetarians.
Oh, this is high-end stuff, Lori. This goes way beyond coffee and donuts. And the morning. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Now, you're a female business owner. Cool Moose has done so well. That's something to celebrate, too, on another note.
Yeah, we're so, and again, it goes back to our community. They've been with us through the good times, the bad times, and, you know, the times that, you know, we're always trying to evolve. So we're just really grateful for our community.
So come on out and support the community and City Rescue Mission. This is at Cool Moose Cafe. It's Claws for a Cause Saturday night.
Yes.
They are located at 2708 Park Street, right there at the corner of Park and King.
Yes.
And gosh, only 15 tickets left. Let's hope there's no tickets left by the time we get off the air.
Right. Just go on to Eventbrite and you can get a ticket there. Just search under Claws for a Cause. If you're not able to come, you still can donate towards the items that we're trying to raise funds for.
And I can speak to your talents as a chef and a restaurateur. I know the food is going to be great.
Thanks, so Melissa.
People need to get there Saturday night for Claws for a Cause, benefiting City Rescue Mission at Cool Moose Cafe. Get those tickets at Eventbrite, and kudos to you, Lori Jarvis. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, that's our program. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is station digital editor. We always want your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the latest on the push to legalize recreational marijuana here in Florida. Where do you stand? That conversation's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for some great music. We'll see you in the morning.
Have you checked out Oddball yet? It's a new podcast from WJCT with additional support from Bold Bean Coffee Roasters, and it's pretty fascinating. This local family finds a metal ball on their property, and then the thing starts rolling around seemingly with a mind of its own. The Navy and UFO investigators took interest, and things got really weird.
Yeah, so are you insinuating, Lindsay, that my father was like some kind of UFO kleptomaniac?
It's just too much publicity.
Subscribe to Oddball now wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.